Please come back with me to 2 Kings chapter number 17, and I want us to pick up at verse 32. This whole section in 2 Kings 17 is a laundry list as to why God kicked the northern Israelis out of northern Israel and sent them into Assyrian exile. They had sinned grievously in their worship of other gods and goddesses. It then goes on and explains how they were eventually replaced in the Promised Land, northern Israel's portion of the Promised Land, by non-Israelis who brought their own gods and goddesses to worship. But those guys ended up being attacked by the wild animals, particularly lions, that had exploded in population during the years after 723, when the land was pretty much just empty and had gone wild. And so when these relocated non-Israelis are trying to eke out a living and pay their taxes to the king of Assyria, they're getting killed in large numbers by these wild animals. And so the king of Assyria can't allow that to happen. He needs that tribute money and can't have his subjects being killed all the time. So his advisors say, well, the reason this is happening is because they don't know how to worship the local god. Or they probably would have said gods, plural. And that makes sense to them, because they all believe that gods are localized, that you have a place where a god is headquartered out of, and his power radiates out from that point. So the god that is in control of the land of Israel needs to be worshipped by the people living in that land. So the solution was, let's send back some priests of the God of northern Israel. And so they do. They send back at least this one main guy. I'm sure he had a lot of helpers that came with him. And this guy sets up headquarters where else but Bethel. Because northern Israel believed from its very inception that God was worshipped in the form of a golden calf, the first two of which were located at Bethel and Dan. So they have now put probably a new calf at Bethel, and these non-Israelis are coming there and learning from this Israeli priest how to worship the God of the land. And of course, he's giving them a mixture of information from the scripture itself, I mean the books of Moses, but it's coming in the form of this twisted calf worship. And these non-Israelis are now becoming kind of worshipers of a twisted form of God, Yahweh, mixed with the worship of their own local gods and goddesses from where they've come from. So this is the beginning, this is the foundation of how the Samaritan religion gets started. There's a lot more to it than this, but this is the beginning of it. So let's pick it up in 2 Kings 17:32. We just had a list before this of the gods and goddesses that these foreigners are worshiping and brought with them. Verse 32, they also feared he who is. Now, again, I throw the caveat in. He who is that they are worshiping and learning to worship is in the form of the golden calf. And so that's a problem. They also feared he who is, and appointed from among themselves all sorts of people as priests of the high places, who sacrifice for them in the shrines of the high places. So they feared he who is, but also served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away. So you've got this hodgepodge of worship rituals that the name of he who is also being attached. To this day, they do according to the former manner. So whoever's writing this, what prophet writer is writing this down, I think is writing in a time period after the Assyrian and Babylonian exiles, but probably before, although it could be in connection with, the returns of Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah. Because all three of those famous persons had run-ins with the Samaritans of the northern Israel area. Verse number 34 again. To this day they do according to the former manner. They do not fear he who is, and they do not follow the statutes or the rules or the law or the commandments that he who is commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. So I'm going to clarify that into saying they did not properly follow those things. They've got the information there, but they're mixing it with all sorts of other stuff. And so it's not legit. If you're mixing illegitimate information in with the Bible, then you're not really following the Bible, are you? Verse number 35. He who is made a covenant with them and commanded them, you shall not fear other gods or bow yourself to them or serve them or sacrifice to them, but you shall fear he who is, who brought you out of the land of Egypt with great power and with an outstretched arm. This is more of the history here, that when they first came into the promised land, this is what they were told. Don't be mixing it up with the Canaanites and their religion. You shall bow yourself to him, that is to he who is, and to him you shall sacrifice. And the statutes and the rules and the law and the commandment that he wrote for you, you know, through Moses, that information came, you shall always be careful to do. You shall not fear other gods. You shall not forget the covenant that I have made with you. You shall not fear other gods. If you keep getting it repeated, that's pretty important. But you shall fear he who is your God, and he will deliver you out of the hands of your enemies. So that's what God had told them when they first came into the promised land. That is what God repeated to them through prophets and priest teachers for years, for decades, for centuries. But what do we read? Verse 40, however, they would not listen, but they did according to their former manner. So even now, after the Assyrian exile begins in 723 BC, they're still not following. They're still mixing up with the locals. So these nations feared he who is and also served their carved images. Their children did likewise, and their children's children, as their fathers did, so they do to this day. At this point, I want to talk about something that happened probably after Israel is deported, and the Assyrians move these non-Israelis into the land north of Judea. But before Assyria pushes against southern Judah, because that, I told you, that's coming, that's prophesied, that's been talked about by quite a few of the prophets. But we're not quite ready for that event yet. So I think this next very short historical comment is related to the time period of the the low 720s into the high 17s. That's 719, 718, 717, somewhere in there, okay? And so it's from 2 Kings chapter 18, and it's verse number 7 is where I want us to go. And it's the second part of verse number 7. And this is a reference to King Hezekiah. It says in the first part of verse 7, he who is was with him, wherever he went out, he prospered. So things went well for Hezekiah once he became the solo king and he cleansed the temple and all the things we talked about him. But then he gets into some sort of arrangement with the king of Assyria, probably around the time that the Assyrians took over northern Israel. Southern Judah must have made some sort of arrangement, tributary arrangement with Assyria. We don't read about it anywhere specifically, but it must be in place for this to be accurate. Verse 7, part B says, he rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. So Hezekiah says, I am not going to do what the Assyrian king wants me to do. I'm not going to be paying tribute anymore. Verse 8, he does something else. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory from watchtower to fortified city. Now that's interesting, because when the Assyrians swept down and took over northern Israel, they also swept through Philistia and took it over. And so Judah's king just went over and took over the Philistine territory that had been under Assyrian control. And so he is sticking his thumb in the eye of Assyria. And Sennacherib, on behalf of his father Sargon, is not going to be a happy camper about that. And we'll get to that in a little bit. First, we need to go back to the book of Isaiah and pick up where we dropped off, chapter number 29. We don't know exactly when these prophecies were uttered, but I want to throw them in here because they are preparatory to understanding what's going on when Assyria tries to take over southern Judah, specifically the capital city of Jerusalem, and they can't get the city of Jerusalem under their thumb. So chapter 29 of Isaiah, starting at verse 1. Ah, Ariel, Ariel, the city where David encamped. So Ariel is a nickname for the city of Jerusalem. Ari is lion of. And then El is God in its generic form. And so Ariel means lion of God. And so Jerusalem has a nickname of being the lion of God. And so David was once there. I mean, he took it over and made it his capital city. Ah, Ariel, Ariel, the city where David encamped, add year to year. Let the feasts run their round. So just continue living year by year, month by month, festival by festival. Just keep going through the calendar. Verse 2, yet I will distress Ariel, and there shall be moaning and lamentation, and she will be to me like an Ariel. Now, this is where we get a bit of a play on words, perhaps, or possibly just an alternate understanding on the word Ariel. As I said, the word Ariel can very easily be seen as meaning lion of God. But in, I think it's a different vocalization. It can mean the place where you burn stuff, you know, by the altar hearth. And so it could be that we're playing on the word here and says that even though Ariel started out being my lion, it's now turning into my fireplace where things get burned up because judgment is coming. Verse number 3, and I will encamp against you all around. I will besiege you with towers, and I will raise siege works against you, and you will be brought low. So clearly not good stuff. And we know that Assyria is going to come against Judah, but they'll never really affect any decent attack upon Jerusalem. That won't happen until the Babylonians, and that will be very definitive. So this prophecy seems to be more long-term than just simply for the Assyrians. From the earth you shall speak. From the dust your speech will be bowed down. Your voice shall come from the ground like the voice of a ghost. From the dust your speech shall whisper. So basically, yeah, things are going to happen to you where you'll be begging from the place of dust for me to save you. But the multitudes of your foreign foes shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the ruthless like passing chaff. And in an instant, suddenly, you will be visited by he who is of the armies, hosts, with thunder, with earthquake, and great noise, with whirlwind and tempest, and the flame of a devouring fire. This is probably a reference to you're going to get yourself invaded. And you're going to have these foreigners come in. They're going to be raising these dust clouds. And there will be turmoil. There will be disruption. It'll be like thunder and earthquake and whirlwinds and out of control wildfires all rolled up together. And the multitude of all the nations that fight against Ariel, all that fight against her in her stronghold and distress her, shall be like a dream, a vision in the night. So even though God is predicting bad things will eventually happen to Jerusalem, there is a time past that when it will be forgotten because God will intervene on their behalf and protect them and provide for them and bring them back into his relationship. And then all this will seem like a bad dream. As when a hungry man dreams, behold, he's eating, and then he awakes with his hunger not satisfied. Oh, that I hate that. Every once in a while, I'll have a dream of eating, and I'll be eating something delicious, and then I'll wake up, and it was only a dream. And I'm like, oh, man. Well, that's exactly what he's using here. Verse 8 continues, as when a thirsty man dreams, behold, he's drinking, and he awakes faint with his thirst not quenched. Now, this is much more serious than what I was just talking about for myself. This is like a starving person dreaming that he's eating, and then it turns out he's not. Or a person that's not getting enough water in himself every day dreams about drinking water, and he wakes up, and he finds out that he's still got a parched throat. He's still super dehydrated. So shall the multitude of all the nations be that fight against Mount Zion. So they're not going to get it done. And we know that's going to happen with the Assyrians. They won't get it done. Astonish yourselves and be astonished. Blind yourselves and be blind. Be drunk, not with wine. Stagger, not with strong drink. For he who is has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep, and has closed your eyes, that is the prophets, and closed your heart, your heads, that is, the seers. Now we get back to the, shall we say, sarcasm or irony that pops up in the book of Isaiah from time to time, where God basically says, yeah, I want to help you out. I could help you out, but you don't want it. And so you end up just making things worse for yourself. Verse 11. And the vision of all this has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed. When men give it to a one who can read, saying, read this, he says, I can't. It's sealed. So God's information being made readily available, but sealed in this case. You give it to a person that can read, and they said, I can't read it. It's all sealed up. But then verse 12, and when they give the book to one who cannot read, saying, read this, he says, I can't read. So he doesn't even look at the fact that it's sealed. And so God would like to help these people out, but they are stacking the deck against themselves by not trusting them, not trusting him. That is why we come now to a passage that Jesus quotes against the Pharisees of his day, against the religious, unbelieving leaders of his day, unbelieving in the sense that here is Messiah, the fulfiller of prophecies, right in front of them, doing supernatural things just like was predicted he would do. And they won't take that information at face value. They blow it off. They reject it. Verse 13. And so he who is, or the Lord, Adonai, said, because this people draw near with their mouth, and they honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, and their fear of me is a commandment taught by men. So this is the reason Jesus picks this, is because the people of his day were just like the people of Isaiah's day. They are talking a lot of religious talk, talking a lot of spiritual stuff, but they didn't have relationship. They were going through the spiritual motions, the religious rituals. They were genuflecting at the right time, kneeling at the right time, standing at the right time, smiling at the right time, singing at the right time. But inside, they had no connection with God. It was just letters on a page that they weren't interested in. And so God says, this is what I'm going to have to do. Verse 14, therefore, behold, I will again do wonderful things with this people, with wonder upon wonder, and the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the discernment of their discerning men shall be hidden. So I'm going to have to do some amazing things, which included judgment, which included the coming of the Messiah, the atoning death, the resurrection, the ascension, all of that, the start of the church. God's going to have to do more amazing things. Verse 15, and you who hide deep from he who is your counsel, that is, you try to keep secrets from God, whose deeds are in the dark, who say, who sees us? Who knows us? You know, nobody knows what's going on with us. You turn things upside down. Shall the potter be regarded as the clay, that the thing should say of its maker, he didn't make us, he didn't make me, or the thing formed say of him who formed it, he doesn't understand, he doesn't have any understanding. See, it's goofiness here. Can you imagine a pot on the throw wheel while it's being made going, he's not making me, he's not making me, or he doesn't know what he's doing. He hasn't a clue. Well, Come on. God is the creator. And yet some of these people were ready to say, God didn't make us. God doesn't have a clue what he's doing. And so it is a great critique from the prophet Isaiah, from God through the prophet Isaiah, of the people in Jerusalem around this time period. Is it not yet a very little while until Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be regarded as a forest? In that day the deaf shall hear the words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind shall see. I actually think that is a reference to the first coming of Jesus, when he does great miracles, including the giving of sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf, but also to his second coming, when he does away with all that stuff amongst his resurrected and transformed saints. The meek shall obtain fresh joy in he who is, and the poor among mankind shall exult in the Holy One of Israel. So good things are coming, even though there are bad people rejecting relationship right now. For the ruthless shall come to nothing, and the scoffers cease. So eventually, these guys will be dealt with by God, either in judgment in their own time or judgment at the end of time. And all who watch to do evil shall be cut off, who by a word make a man out to be offender, and lay a snare for him who reproves in the gate, and with an empty plea turn aside him who is in the right. This is an explanation that these guys make accusations against innocent people. They punish innocent people, and God will punish them.